State of South Dakota, the Honorable Chief Justice Stephen R. Jensen presiding, is now in session.
You may be seated. Good morning. The first case set for oral argument is State of South Dakota versus Fitsum Gabri. For the appellant, Drew DeGroat is here from the Minnehaha County State's Attorney's Office. And for appellee, Bo Bluen is present on behalf of the Minnehaha County Public Defender's Office. Each side will have 15 minutes to present your initial arguments, and then Mr. DeGroat, you'll have an extra 5 minutes, or you'll have a five-minute rebuttal at the conclusion. With that, Mr. DeGroat, you may proceed with your argument.
May it please the court, counsel, we are here today for this court to determine the question of whether the defendant's statements made to law enforcement were voluntary. The circuit court has previously ruled that Miranda is not applicable in this case. However, the circuit court ruled that the defendant's statements were involuntary because the court concluded that the defendant had clear difficulty in understanding officers. The court was not convinced that the defendant totally understood his rights at the time. The state argues that the circuit court combined a voluntariness analysis with that of a custody analysis. When reviewing a voluntariness case, this court standard of review is de novo. Although there are subsidiary factual questions that deserve deference, this court ultimately reaches an independent determination on the question of voluntariness.
Mr. DeGroat, can I ask a question quick and just kind of help orient myself, and I'll ask Mr. Bluen as well, but as I see the statement, look at it, read it, I watch the video, I'm not sure I see admissions. I see exculpatory statements. And so what's being excluded, what's being suppressed, is it the state's theory that these exculpatory statements are admissible, and is that why we're here?
Yes, and the reason why we're here is the court excluded all the statements made by the defendant. The state agrees these appear, by all intents and purposes, to be exculpatory. They also prove the second factor of the voluntariness test, that the suspect had the capacity to resist pressure. But the reason why we're here is because the defendant could use those statements. If those are excluded, he could claim that the sexual contact was consensual, and this it would be for impeachment purposes to allow the state to cross the defendant or to counter any argument that the sexual contact was consensual.
Yeah, I wondered about that. Okay, thank you. That helps me.
It is the state's burden to prove by a preponderance of the evidence that the defendant's statements are voluntary. Now, Justice Salter mentioned the video in this case. The facts in this case are not necessarily at dispute. What is at dispute is the application of those facts with the law. And I'm not going to rehash the entire factual facts here today, but I do think some relevant facts are important to highlight. On February 24th, 2021, a Sioux Falls Police Department detective went to the defendant's home in order to execute a search warrant for the defendant's DNA. Prior to that date, the detective had limited knowledge of the defendant. What he did know is that the alleged victim described the defendant as real African. The detective had a prior phone conversation with the defendant, although that was abruptly ended. The detective testified that he wasn't sure if there was a language barrier or if there was communication errors because the defendant was speaking so softly over the phone. Nevertheless, on February 24, 2021, an assisting officer conducted a traffic stop. He had a body camera on, captured the entire interaction on video. The defendant complied with prompts from law enforcement. He complied with the detective, sat in the detective's unmarked vehicle in the passenger seat. The door remained completely open. The assisting officer stood directly outside the passenger door with the detective was in the driver's seat. Most of that time spent in that vehicle was spent executing the search warrant and obtaining a sample of the defendant's DNA. A search warrant inventory sheet was completed by the detective, and the defendant declined to sign it. After that, the defendant made a statement that he did not know the girl. The detective then asked the defendant whether he wanted to talk about what happened. The defendant was non-responsive. The detective eventually handed the ID to the defendant and said, "You're free to go." The defendant continued to sit in the vehicle in silence for approximately 15 seconds before the detective asked again whether the defendant wanted to talk about what happened. And this is where the issue comes, where the defendant takes issue with some of the detective's statements. The detective said, "Here's the thing, if you had sex with her, that's what you need to explain to me now." But he quickly clarified and said, "Not now, but give me a call and we'll talk about it. Here's my card. If you had sex with her, you had sex with her. The DNA on that kit is going to tell us whether it was you who had sex with her." After that statement, the defendant then said something to the effect of he had a problem. The detective followed up on that statement, and the defendant confirmed that he couldn't achieve an erection. The detective then asked specific, pointed questions, asking whether he had oral sex with the alleged victim or digitally penetrated the alleged victim, and the defendant denied any sexual contact with the victim. It was at that point that the interaction ceased. The defendant spent an entire time in that unmarked vehicle was approximately 5 minutes and 20 seconds. The dialogue that the defendant and the circuit court found so persuasive lasted less than 2 minutes. When reviewing a voluntariness under due process, it's a two-factor test. The first factor is conduct of law enforcement, and the second factor is the suspect's capacity to resist pressure. In this case, there was no coercive conduct or police overreach.
Counsel, I want to ask you a question about the policy of the Sioux Falls Police Department to require an interpreter. What can you say about that?
So the detective stated, I don't know the policy specifically, but the detective did state during the suppression hearing if it would be a prolonged interview or he would like to ask more questions and spend more time with the defendant that he would have sought an interpreter. But in this case, he was serving the search warrant. He indicated to the defendant that he was only, "Do you want to talk about what happened? Give me a call and you can come down and talk about it." He wasn't intending on a prolonged interrogation, non-custodial interrogation at the time. He was just there for the purposes of the search warrant and asked the defendant whether he wanted to talk about what happened.
So after he told him that he was free to leave, he did ask questions that would be designed to elicit an incriminating response.
Yes, and the state doesn't deny that he asked questions, and the defendant correctly phrases them as specific pointed questions. However, the U.S. Supreme Court has stated that a traffic stop like this one was, it was a traffic stop, an officer may ask a detainee moderate number of questions to determine the identity and try and obtain information either confirming or dispelling any suspicions. So there's nothing impermissible about the officer asking a short or moderate amount of questions in that circumstance. Where it would be impermissible is if he'd go above and beyond, let's say at the police station, or if it was a prolonged stop for more than the 5 minutes and 20 seconds that that defendant sat in that vehicle.
Those principles are generally designed to assist courts in determining whether someone's in custody for purposes of triggering the Miranda requirement, though. Do they really even apply to a voluntariness inquiry like we have before us here, where it seems, I mean, the circuit court held that he wasn't in custody and subject to Miranda, and I don't think we have that issue before us.
Yes, and there's another case in Schleckloff v. Bustamante where the U.S. Supreme Court had reviewed voluntariness jurisprudence, and in that case, the Supreme Court has said in none of those voluntariness cases does the court rule that due process clause requires the prosecution to prove as part of its initial burden that the defendant knew he had a right to refuse the answers to questions put. There's certainly a factor, but the law enforcement officers can ask questions during a non-custodial setting. And that's where I think the state argues that the circuit court erred by combining a voluntariness review with the custody arguments. Now, in this case, back to the conduct of law enforcement, this court has held that a confession or statement is involuntary if it is the actual moving cause of a confession or statement. It must be more than a but-for causation because causation, in that sense, has never been the test of voluntariness. And that's in State v. Tuttle. To put another way, the U.S. Supreme Court stated in Colorado v. Connolly that coercive police activity is a necessary predicate for the finding of voluntariness. In this case, the officer's conduct cannot be deemed objectively coercive or overreaching. The total time spent in that vehicle, again, was 5 minutes and approximately 5 minutes and 20 seconds. The questions were pointed and direct. No trickery or deceit was used. No attempt to try and trip up the defendant in any way. No misrepresentations were made. No promises of leniency. Certainly no threats of physical harm. And obviously, the stop was not prolonged.
So combining the questioning by law enforcement with the language barrier and the lack of an interpreter, does that amount to coercive police conduct?
The defendant's argument is that's per se coercive conduct when you don't have an interpreter present during a non-custodial interrogation. That's simply not true. No jurisdiction in the United States has held that an interpreter is required during a non-custodial setting. The state doesn't deny that that's a factor when reviewing voluntariness and the suspect's capacity to resist pressure, but it's not per se coercive conduct.
So it could indicate susceptibility to coercion, but it's not coercion itself?
Correct, yes. And in this case, the defendant showed he had the capacity to resist pressure. You take, when looking at the suspect's capacity to resist pressure, you take the person's age, personal characteristics, length of the stop, whether any psychological techniques were used by law enforcement. However, this court has held that some psychological techniques may be utilized when questioning a suspect. In this case, the suspect, in this case, defendant, showed he had the capacity to resist pressure. He declined to sign the search warrant inventory sheet. He denied knowing the victim at all. He denied any sexual contact. What he did prove on the video, he proved himself he had the capacity to resist pressure. He proved he knew how to say no to law enforcement, and he did it multiple times. The state would argue that this case is just like Murado. In that case, the court held that the defendant's statements were voluntary because there was no trickery or deceit used by law enforcement. In that case, Murado, his second language was English, and the law enforcement didn't use any trickery or deceit, misrepresentations. It wasn't prolonged because conduct of law enforcement is a necessary predicate in order to find voluntariness. Now, there is one case that the state believes that is on point in this case, and that's an opinion issued by Judge Moreno out of the U.S. District Court of South Dakota, and that's U.S. v. Conquering Bear. In that case, Judge Moreno reviewed the Miranda issue, found Miranda wasn't applicable, but he also reviewed the voluntariness factor. When reviewing the voluntariness factor, the defendant argued that he had severe English literacy issues and no ASL interpreter was provided. Judge Moreno, in his memorandum decision, said, while that argument is creative, it's unavailing. Law enforcement doesn't need to use special care just because there's a vulnerable suspect. It goes back to the voluntariness test, the two-factor voluntariness test, which works. We don't need to heighten the burden and require interpreters during non-custodial settings. And in the opinion issued by Judge Moreno, the facts that he reviewed could easily be substituted for this case. The detective should have furnished the defendant with an interpreter to ensure effective communication. However, failing to supply the defendant with one was not a form of coercion sufficient to make the statements involuntary. The defendant appeared to understand the detective wanted to ask him questions about having sex with the victim, just like this case. The defendant cooperated with the detective, responded to questions, and more importantly, the defendant never requested an interpreter or a lawyer to stop the interview. In this case, the defendant never asked for an interpreter, and he never asked for an attorney to stop the interview. Because the detective took no action that could objectively be considered coercive or overreaching, there is nothing to refute the voluntariness of the defendant's statements. Now, going back to the two-factor test, for conduct of law enforcement, we have nothing, no police overreach, and no coercive conduct, no trickery or deceit, no misrepresentations, they didn't prolong the stop, no threats of physical harm, no promises of leniency for cooperation, the suspect's capacity to resist pressure. Knew how to say no to law enforcement. He declined to sign the search warrant inventory sheet. He declined knowing the victim. He declined any sexual contact whatsoever with the victim. He showed he had the capacity to resist pressure. Based upon that two-factor voluntariness test, the state has met its burden by a preponderance of the evidence, and we ask this court reverse the circuit court's ruling that the defendant's statements were involuntary. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Good.
Mr. Balloon, you may proceed with your argument at this time.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. At the very core of due process and the right against compulsory self-incrimination are fundamental notions of fairness and justice. An essential aim of due process is to prevent fundamental unfairness and the use of evidence against an accused.
Help me understand in that regard. Help me understand your suppression motion. What are you, well, I understand, I think what you're seeking to exclude, which is everything you said, your client said, yes?
Correct.
Why?
Well, I think that we're dealing with a felony rape case, and a statement which was really pronounced in very broken English, saying, I have problem for sex. I think, you know, that
which would seem to be exculpatory, along with, I don't know that girl, seems to be exculpatory.
On that note, I would just say I listened to the video, and I hear Mr. Gebre say, I don't know this. I didn't hear him say, I don't know this girl.
Okay. Even if it's as you say, those don't seem to be admissions. Do you disagree?
Not necessarily. I think that the way the words that were spoken are going to be used as essentially inculpatory, if not on their face, but used against him in presenting their case.
How would they be?
Well, because there was DNA testing in this case that at least found that it was consistent, that there was some DNA that was consistent with Mr. Gebre on the rape kit. And so that essentially opens a can of worms with this statement. What did it mean? What kind of problems do you have with sex? I think it could be twisted a number of ways in saying...
I'm sorry, I don't mean to take your time, but is that an admission? Under what rule of evidence does that come in? In the case in chief for the state?
Well, I think that they're going to argue that it's maybe consciousness of guilt or trying to, it's inconsistent with the DNA testing.
Impeachment.
Correct.
But in the state's case in chief, he hasn't testified.
Yeah, and I think the state may try to get it in as a statement.
And the other reason why I ask is if the concern is really voluntariness, there's a couple different ways I suppose it could go, but one of the ways I might have expected the case and the record to develop is that the argument is and the evidence is that this is involuntary and needs to be excluded because what was said wasn't accurate. But I don't really see that in this case. Am I missing that? The language barrier, in other words, was so bad that your client didn't know what he was saying, and either that's a mistake or it's not voluntary, but it's something along those lines. But I don't see that as the argument here.
And, I mean, that certainly could be an argument before the circuit court at a later time as far as the evidentiary-wise, the reliability of these statements. I agree with that.
Counsel, and this is kind of along the same lines of Justice Salter's questions, and in reading the transcript of the answers, I see those as exculpatory and not inculpatory statements as well. Are you aware of specific cases where a court has found that there can be a coercion of a denial that would mount to an involuntary statement? Because that's really what we have here in my view.
Well, I'm not aware of a specific case finding that, and I could certainly supplement a briefing in regards to that issue, but the statement in itself, of course, has to be damaging to the individual's case. We have a situation where there's a large language barrier here. That's clear. He's muttering statements that are going to be used against him, and in conducting that analysis, I think that there is an argument that they were involuntary. But I want to get into The Supreme Court of the United States has said that there's no all-encompassing definition of voluntariness that is mechanically applicable to other cases where this question has arisen. There's no single controlling criterion, no single factor, such as length of questioning, that can be dispositive. And the Kansas Appellate Court in Fernandez-Torres stated that the outcome does not depend on a tally of factors for each side. Each relevant factor should not be assessed in isolation. The collective effect of the circumstances drives the assessment. And it's within this broad framework that the court's determination must be whether Mr. Gebre, his statements were the product of a rational and free will. And that's a burden on the state to prove by a preponderance of the evidence. And so the court looks closely at both characteristics of the defendant as well as the details surrounding the questioning. Now, the heart of the state's case is that there was no coercion whatsoever in this case. Now, I think it's important to talk about how the court views this term, coercion, within the context of the voluntariness inquiry. Courts have looked to the surrounding circumstances of the questioning to determine what sort of pressure is applied. Are there any inducements? Was there police overreaching? Was the defendant taken advantage of? And coercion is determined from the perspective of the suspect. This is not a case of blatant or of overt coercion. Mr. Gebre was not physically harmed in any way. There were no overt threats or promises made. What we are asserting as improper was the manner in which the questioning was carried out, a far more subtle form of persuasion and inducement, but that was just as effective in compelling a statement in light of his vulnerable characteristics, that being his significant deficiencies in communicating English. And I think it's important to note that the United States Supreme Court in Miller v. Fenton stated that the voluntariness inquiry is not limited to instances in which the claim is that the police conduct was inherently coercive, but applies equally when the interrogation techniques were improper only because, in the particular circumstances of the case, the statement is unlikely to have been the product of a free and rational will. In that same light, the Wisconsin Supreme Court in State v. Hopp observed that evaluating whether police conduct is coercive is dependent on the personal characteristics of the defendant. In other words, they're not viewed independently or in a vacuum. And it is how that questioning interacts with the defendant's characteristics that determines the voluntariness. And so courts looking at subtle coercive measures or persuasion have indicated that the vulnerabilities of a defendant is a more significant factor in the voluntariness calculation. So here we have Mr. Gebre, a 40-year-old African male, speaks to Grinya. As the state pointed out in their brief to the circuit court on February 4, Mr. Gebre had come to the United States 12 years prior, well into his adulthood. His English language skills are significantly limited. Just by looking at the video, you can see that. Now, I think it's important that the detective knew some of these difficulties going in. On December 7th of 2020, he called Mr. Gebre. The call only lasted a couple minutes. Mr. Gebre was inaudible much of the time, trying to spell his name for the detective, which was an extremely laborious exercise. Ultimately, the detective says, "I can't understand you," and the phone call ends. And so 2.5 months later, he has another officer pull him over in a marked patrol car. When the officer approaches him, he has to tell him multiple times to get out of the car and what he wants him to do. Mr. Gebre is looking back and forth from the dash to the officer, lifting his hands up in the air. Ultimately, he gets out on the side of the road. They continue to ask him. No audible responses, standing there looking very confused. At one point, the detective tries to get him to give him a thumbs up or a thumbs down. They eventually do get inside the vehicle of the detective, with the officer standing right outside the passenger door with the door propped open, essentially boxing Mr. Gebre in.
Counsel, is that positioning of the officer the source of the video that is available for our review?
That's correct. All of that is on video.
So if his presence there allowed his body cam, so to speak, to record everything that occurred inside?
That is correct.
I don't want to parse the record, but en route to the detective's car, they asked him for his license or his ID, which he provided promptly. They asked him what time he had to go to work. He said 4:30. They had asked twice, but he said 4:30. I mean, that happened too.
That's correct. And I'm not saying that Mr. Gebre didn't understand some words in English. But I think there's also significant evidence that demonstrates that he had significant deficiencies in the English language.
He wasn't obligated to, of course. As you say, it's the state's burden, but we're really, the record really is left to our inferential sort of conclusions that what you're describing, Mr. Blewin, and what we're seeing is tantamount to him having these profound limitations. He didn't testify for limited purpose, which he could have. I don't understand English. I didn't understand this detective. I didn't understand patrolman. Tigrinya is my first language, and I'm really at a disadvantage in English. Could have, didn't.
That's correct. And I think, you know, the circuit court was able to listen to the testimony and watch the video himself and made a finding of fact that there was a disregard, ignoring a clear language barrier. And I think that that deserved deferential review from the court and a standard of clear error. But I think the heart of the questioning here, what we're saying is improper, is when you look at the questioning, it's clear he's trying to elicit some information on the allegations at that point, despite a clear language barrier. He says, do you have questions for me? Do you want to talk about what happened at all? We're not going to talk about it here, but we can make an arrangement to talk about it. Do you want to talk about what happened? Here's your driver's license. You're free to go. Do you want to talk about what happened, though? Here's my thing, man. If you had sex with her, that's what you need to explain now, okay? Not right this minute, but call me and we'll talk about it. Here's my card. If you had sex with her, the DNA is going to tell us on that kid if that was you. And so I do think that what better way to confuse someone who has a deficiency in English language than to throw 5 or 6 questions at him at once and to see if you can compel him to say something on it. And if there was any doubt of whether he wanted to elicit statements regarding the allegations, he did go forward and ask them specific statements. Did you digitally penetrate her or have oral sex with her? And I think to describe the deficiencies in English, Gebre said, I have problem too. How I? And as he's struggling to articulate himself, the detective keeps following up and saying, what's that? Oh, yeah. And then Gebre says, I have problem too. And then why I sex says. And finally, the I have problem for sex. Now, all of this happened while the other officer was still over his right shoulder, and there was another patrol vehicle that showed up with 2 additional officers. But what struck me as problematic was the detective testified at the suppression hearing that he didn't want to question Gebre about the alleged incident in the vehicle. And that the reason, on page 25 of the suppression hearing, the reason he didn't request an interpreter was because he didn't intend to ask detailed questions. Otherwise, he would have requested an interpreter. At the same time, he admitted to asking to elicit these immediate answers. Now, I want to touch briefly on State v. Morato, that the state indicates is similar to this case. I think when you look at that case, there are some significant distinctions. One being, you could see that the conversation in English between that defendant was in conversational English. The detective there made sure that he understood what was going on and what he was saying. And Morato responded, yes, I understand what you're saying. And he made sure he knew that he didn't have to talk, but that he could leave. And Morato said, yes, I know. And in that case, there was never any demand, you need to tell me now. That wasn't present in Morato. And I do want to touch briefly on U.S. v. Conquering Bear that the state raises. I think that this case is distinguishable. In that case, we had a person born deaf who couldn't speak. Officers, to my knowledge, didn't have any prior contact with him. When they tried to, they first Mirandized him, and then they tried to question him using writings and computer, which they fairly assumed would have been a legitimate way to intelligently communicate. However, they were wrong, and they immediately cut off the questioning when they figured out that, oh, no, he cannot speak. The court indicated that in that case, because they thought that this would be a good way to communicate, that that wasn't taking advantage of the defendant. There was no bad faith there. And I think in this case, with the finding of complete disregard of a language barrier, to move forward with the questioning is what took advantage of Mr. Gebre.
May I ask you a question? These are on the wall. Go ahead. So the remedy of exclusion, as you know, is designed to promote or deter overreaching by law enforcement and promote better practices. What does the law enforcement officer do here differently? What would exclusion deter in this case?
He doesn't, where you have a clear and obvious language barrier, where that's been established in a previous phone call and in the vehicle, where he's muttering incomprehensible words, you don't go forward with the questioning at that point. I think it's common sense. You don't try to push it and see if you can get him to mutter something out that you're going to use against him later. And for those reasons, I'm asking respectfully the court to affirm the circuit court's order suppressing the statements as involuntary under due process. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. DeGroote, you may proceed with your five-minute rebuttal.
Thank you. First and foremost, the defendant argues that the circuit court's finding deserves deference and clear error finding. That's not the standard of review. The standard of review is de novo. This is this court's case and makes an independent determination on the case. There's no finding of clear error necessary. This is this court's case, not the circuit court's anymore. As far as the defendant's statements that the law enforcement took advantage of the defendant, again, the defendant knew how to say no. Just like Justice Salter pointed out, the detective wasn't sure if there was a clear language barrier. Obviously, the defendant disagrees and states that there's a clear language barrier. However, he responded to prompts from law enforcement, handed over his ID, but most importantly, he never asked for an interpreter. Most importantly, the questions at issue here came after the defendant was told he was free to leave and declined to do so. He continued to sit in that vehicle, and they sat in silence for approximately 15 seconds. Law enforcement officer wasn't planning on asking him questions. The defendant put the law enforcement officer in that position when he continued to sit in that vehicle when he said he was free to go. Law enforcement did not overreach in this case.
Counsel, we'll look at the totality of the circumstances. What is the record evidence regarding the defendant's prior contacts with law enforcement?
Yes, and I'm glad you brought that up. He does have prior contact with law enforcement. In 2016, he was arrested for DUI. And then again in 2020, he was arrested for DUI. And actually in that 2020 case, he represented himself pro se and received a suspended imposition of sentence on that DUI.
Did he have an interpreter?
And yes, he did.
Does the records show that?
Yes, the records do. E-courts will show that he had an interpreter in those cases. However, there is... I'm trying to find it. Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals has stated that just because a criminal defendant has a constitutional right in some criminal procedure aspects does not mean that he has the right to an interpreter during a police interview. And I believe that was Chen v. DiMacco. So that really isn't relevant for the purposes of a non-custodial setting if he had an interpreter for those criminal procedures where he is entitled to one. But he did have one, and he's had prior encounters with law enforcement absent, and I don't know in the record if there was an interpreter during the field sobriety tests of those DUI arrests or not, but I do know he had prior encounters with law enforcement. And back to the defendant's attempt to distinguish Conquering Bear from this case. In this case, the defendant wasn't born in the U.S. His first language wasn't English. Much like the person that is a vulnerable suspect in Conquering Bear wasn't born being able to hear. But in that case, the distinguishing factor, there is one distinguishing factor, yes, law enforcement officers cut off the interview when they realized there was difficulties with communication. However, in this case, the detective testified he wasn't sure if there was clear difficulties in communications because the defendant responded to prompts appropriately. He did what he was told to do. He got out of the vehicle, sat in the vehicle, and responded no to each question that was put by the detective.
So then are you suggesting that the officer's testimony that he didn't think there was a language barrier, that we review that de novo if the court made a finding there was a language barrier?
Yes, that is reviewed de novo. You can, although there are some subsidiary factual questions that deserve deference. This court ultimately does reach an independent determination. So if this court deems that something that's worth reviewing, this court has the ability to do so based upon the standards set forth by this court. And then the last thing, again, there is no police overreach, no coercive conduct. The suspect showed he had the capacity to resist pressure. When he said no multiple times, he denied knowing the victim, declined to sign the search warrant inventory sheet, and denied any sexual contact with the victim. The state has proven its burden by a preponderance of the evidence, and we'd ask this court reverse the circuit court's decision that the defendant's statements were involuntary. Thank you.
Thank you. That will conclude the arguments this morning. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. We'll be in recess until 9:45.